Small businesses are the cornerstones of our local communities, and small business owners are hardworking and passionate people who are chasing down their ambitions while there's a lot on the line. So, let Verizon champion your small business dreams. Whether you own a small business, are scaling one, or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon, well, they've got you back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business. When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. Real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now. This is Star Talk. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. You're a personal astrophysicist, and this is going to be a Cosmic Queries edition. And I've got a guest co-host. She's an old-timer with us, Marcia Belsky. Marcia, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It is always so fun to be here. I learned so much. This is my only postgraduate education that I get.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
It's an honor to be back.
Great. So since you do agree to keep coming back, it can't be all that bad for you.
Yes.
So today we're going to talk about asteroids, and our expert guest is Marina Brozovic. Thank you for joining Star Talk. You work at the Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, California, and presumably they don't only do jet propulsion. So what is the Jet Propulsion Laboratories? Tell everybody.
We are specialized in robotic explorations of the solar system. So we run missions like, you know, there was Cassini on Saturn, and we run Mars rovers. But we also do a lot of science. So one of the science work that we do here are asteroids. And to be more specific, we do some very kind of unique work because we work with planetary radars. We work with this very large, planetary radar in Mojave Desert in California. So it is really huge. Dish, like 70 meters in size. And that is not really by design, you know, planetary radar. It's used for spacecraft communication. But when missions are not using it, then they give it to, you know, our scientists to observe asteroids.
So you piggybacked what was the original design of that telescope, of that radar?
Yeah, it is part of the Deep Space Network. So NASA has, you know, you have to communicate with your spacecraft. And so NASA has these big dishes all around the world. It has it in Australia, it has it in Spain, and it has it in Mojave Desert.
So, Marcia, is it just me, or does like the phrase Deep Space Network just sound like the coolest thing ever?
It is. So all of this is blowing my mind. Like, this is so cool. Yeah, all I know about asteroids is that people on Twitter were speculating that one was about to crash into Earth because they blew up one with a rocket ship. Apparently Marina told me that's not true. So that's very comforting.
Twitter generally is not true.
What? Are you serious? Wow.
Wait, so Marina, what do we need radar for if we have regular telescopes that can spot asteroids?
Well, so optical telescopes are the ones that discover asteroids. But radar is a follow-up instrument.
But just to be clear, an optical telescope specializes in visible light, and a radar telescope is radio.
Correct. Waves.
Okay, so yeah, so let's go.
Yes, we are bouncing. So we're kind of bring your flashlight. You know, optical telescopes, asteroids are being, you know, they reflect some sunlight. You see them as little moving points on a plane of sky. You measure where this little moving point is, fit the orbit. There you go. With radar, there are two things that we do with radar. One is we ping them. So we, you know, bounce off our little flashlight microwaves off the asteroid, which gives us exactly very precise location where it is with respect to us. So line of sight distance. And then we also always say, you know, in optical telescopes, asteroids look like speck of lights. And with radar, they become small worlds.
And just to be clear, that is the original origin of the word asteroid. When, was it Herschel? Who first named them, saw that there were these dots of light moving across the sky, and there were only dots of light, just like regular stars, because stars are so far away, they're just dots of light. So he described them as star-like, asteroid.
Oh.
Aster, Latin for star, oid is like. So they're nothing like stars, but to an optical telescope, it's a star that's moving. That's right. It's exactly right. That's the origin of the word asteroid. Okay, so now I apparently you weren't content just knowing it was a dot moving across the sky, were you, Marina?
Yeah. So with radar, so most of the time we are observing near Earth asteroids, and they're usually, say, within 1/10 of astronomical unit from Earth. And they're about at least several hundred meter in size. So they're fairly close and fairly large.
So an astronomical unit is the Earth-Sun distance taken as a new yardstick.
Correct.
To measure distances. Yes. Yes,
yes, that is a kind of a yardstick for us. But I'm saying, so it is, we observe relatively close. And as I said, they are relatively, large asteroids. But we are able, you know, so they know to be millions of kilometers away from Earth. And we are able to see something that is 6 feet in size. We can see surface boulders. It is that level of detail.
Whoa.
And you can imagine.
And the asteroid's like, yeah. I didn't even get ready today. Like, don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know you were
photographing me. Yeah.
We get to see a lot of little details. So every kind of observing session knows to be like a mini space mission. Because you're flying, you know, there's asteroid is coming in our neighborhood and we ping him with radar and reveal how it looks like. We know we are very interested always how large it is because, you know, that is one of the kind of key parameters for planetary defense.
You think?
Yeah.
You think?
Okay. Well, so,
Wait, so I've heard rumors that many asteroids might just be piles of rock traveling together, sort of loosely held with like chewing gum and bailing
sticky
wire.
Putty.
Yeah.
So please fix what I just said. Make it right or make it wrong. But I heard tell.
That's what the people are saying.
Yeah, the people are saying on Twitter is saying.
Twitter is saying it's just made of gum and rocks up
I
there.
I guess Twitter was right this time because actually, you know, they are rubble piles. We think, you know, anything larger than about, you know, 200 meters is really loosely held together aggregate of rocks of various sizes. So, you know, like small rocks, big rocks, a lot of fine dust, like regolith. And so, and you actually can see that in space missions. I mean, if you have seen the images of asteroid Bennu that NASA's OSIRIS-REx took, it's rock on a rock on a rock. You know, it's all rocks, just piled up. And if you saw images from the latest DART mission, the one that smashed into the moonlet. You also saw that both of the asteroids, they had huge boulders of very, you know, and basically there's aggregates of rocks loosely held together by gravity.
By their own gravity. So even though they're small, we think of small things as having hardly any gravity, but whatever gravity they have, it's enough so that they have some kind of shape. Otherwise, you expect the rocks to just drift away.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point that you're making because there is something interesting that happens. These rocks, when they spin fast, about 2 hours, very often they end up with a satellite. Because basically, the first two things happen. The kind of the material starts, you know, the starts kind of traveling toward the equator. and it starts kind of, you know, gravity can't pull it anymore. It starts flying off and then it clumps into a satellite. So that is, so that is exactly, you know, we know that.
Wait, Rena, I wanted to become a ring around the moonlet. That would be so cool.
That'd be cool if our moons could have rings. I've always thought that.
I know.
Well, they probably have.
Romina, I want you to work on that and get back to us on Monday
Those
morning.
Those are very hard observations. Those would be very, very hard observations because, you know, you would have to kind of really catch it in action, you know, how there is a ring around some the asteroid and then it's clumping into a moonlet.
Wow.
Well, I think we have questions from our fan base, a Patreon fan base.
We do.
So, Marcia, I haven't seen these. I don't think Marina has seen these either. So you're just pulling these out of the ether right here.
Yes, keeping you on your toes.
Exactly.
They can't hide the conspiracies because they got to reveal the answers right then.
All right. So what do you have, Marcia?
All right. So this first question is from Yaniv from Israel, Yaniv Koss. And it says, why do all asteroids look gray? Are they really gray? If so, why? Or are we always just using black and white cameras?
Oh, I'd like that. Yes. Marina, we want color here. Wait, so what's up with this? What's going on?
Yeah. So they don't, we don't use definitely black and white cameras. There are plenty of spacecraft with the, you know, full color cameras. But asteroids are actually quite dark. They have something, so we measure, you know, how dark they are, and there's something called albedo. It is how much of the sunlight they reflect. So most of them don't have all, they reflect maybe at most about 15 to 20% of sunlight. So they indeed are kind of very various shades of gray.
Dark gray, it sounds like. Yeah.
It's very dark gray. I mean, if you ever kind of looked at the some samples of meteors, they know to be quite gray, except there are certain types. There is one type that is really like almost like a little marble. It's very rare. It's enstatite. It's called enstatite. And it looks literally
instatite. Like it sounds like you just made that up to sell on an infomercial.
Yes.
It's a new glue. Buy some instatite.
On a QVC channel.
That's totally from the QVC channel.
Buy this fancy asteroid.
I don't believe you now, Maria.
They are beautiful. Yeah, they're beautiful kind of marble white with a little kind of gray specks. And they're very pretty. So they're rare. They have like, you know, like 30 to 60, they reflect about 30 to 60% of sunlight. So there are some of them which are really bright, but they know to be also as a charcoal, you know, the ones that have a lot of carbon, they reflect maybe few percent of light. They're mainly actually pretty dark. They don't reflect light.
Okay, perfect. All right, so let's get another one. Okay, so this is from Jen. They say, hi from Michigan. I've been hearing about the Trojan asteroids lately. Did I hear correctly that they are in Jupiter's orbit? And how can that be? I thought that part of the definition of a planet was that it had to clear its orbit.
Ooh, this one.
That's very good.
Jen did some homework on that one.
Jen knows her
stuff. Are we going back to Pluto?
Yeah.
Everything.
Leo's favorite topic.
Marina,
back to Pluto.
Everything lands back at Pluto. And they still can't shake it. We'll get to that answer right when we come back on our first break from Cosmic Queries, the Asteroid Edition, with our guest Marina Brozovic from the Jet Propulsion Labs. We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, I'm Roy Hill Percival, and I support Star Talk on Patreon. Bringing the universe down to Earth, this is Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
We're back, Star Talk, Cosmic Queries Edition. We're talking about asteroids with my co-host, Marcia Belsky. Marcia, welcome back to Star Talk.
Thank you so much. So glad to be back.
And you're in a comedy festival coming up in November, November 13th. Alan Cummings, what does he have to do with this?
So Alan Cummings owns a cabaret bar in the East Village.
That's funny because I saw him on Broadway performing in the musical Cabaret. So maybe somebody saw that and said, we got to keep
full circle.
Full circle, yes.
He knows how to work his brand.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a really great space. It's at East 6th between Avenue A and Avenue B. And
in New York City?
In New York City, yes, in Manhattan. And I'm doing my hour there. It's called Marcia Belsky Evangelical. And it's on November 12th at 7:30 p.m. at Club Cumming, which is Alan Cummings Cabaret Bar. And it's for New York Comedy Festival, so it should be really fun.
And your musical comedy is hilarious.
Thank you
my favorite song, was it 100 Tampons?
Yes, that's the NASA song. It's so funny.
A NASA song called 100 Tampons? That's all I'm going to say. You got to go find out where this woman is coming from.
Yes.
So we have as our guest, our asteroid expert, Marina Brozovic, working at the Jet Propulsion Labs. Could you tell us how you got to where you are? If somebody wants your job, or rather, if someone wants a job like yours, what's your background?
Well, as I said, I started as amateur astronomer. You know, I've been amateur astronomer since high school, and then, you know, I studied physics.
But just to be clear, Marcia, when an amateur astronomer is actually an expert, all right? You would never go to an amateur.
I was gonna say.
You would never go to an amateur neurosurgeon or an amateur. Amateur astronomers are experts in the night sky, and they love nothing better than showing off their telescope to whoever will walk by and stop and look through. Okay, so we got amateur astronomer in the house. So, and then what happened?
I, you know, went to study physics, and I did grad school in physics. Then I was a postdoc at Caltech, and and JPL have very good connections, and there is constant transfer of people between the two. And so when the time came, you know, I interviewed for JPL, and I've been here ever since.
Cool. So does your paycheck say NASA or Caltech?
It is really Caltech.
That's what I was wondering.
We are contractors. Yes. Yeah, we are contractors.
Yeah, yeah,
we are JPL. Yeah, JPL and APL lab.
Okay.
So we are actually contractors of NASA.
APL Applied Physics Lab. That's
Applied Physics Lab.
Back on the East Coast, yeah.
Back on the East Coast. That's our, you know.
Very, very excellent.
But we are NASA lab.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You got it. Okay, so Marcia, that question we left off with, which was, remind me?
Yes, so this was from Jen from Michigan, and they were asking, is it true that there are Trojan asteroids in Jupiter's orbit, and how can that be? Because they thought that part of the definition of a planet was that it had to clear its orbit.
And Pluto is listening to this right now, okay?
Pluto, ears are burning.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, that's a very great question. Yeah, Trojans are a very interesting population of asteroids. They are in a stability points. So there is actually, you know, there. Imagine this triangle between the Jupiter, Sun, and this clump that has that is basically objects are able to orbit there without Jupiter kicking them. So there is a clump of asteroids, Trojan asteroids, along Jupiter orbit that is in front, 60 degrees, and then there is another clump behind, also 60 degrees. And that's where, some, as I said, they're still orbiting the Sun, but Jupiter is never managing to catch up with them to kick them out. So these are, you know, gravity stability points where kind of Jupiter gravity and Sun gravity are at peace. And you can just sit there and also orbit the Sun. And they're very interesting because, you know.
So they basically collected there, right? Nobody put them there. Just asteroids wandering throughout the solar system found it to be a safe space for them, in a sense.
Yeah. Wow. That was and Jupiter is sitting there trying to swat them away.
Yeah, but it can't. It's just, out of reach.
Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there is, I think, the front group of Trojans, so the one that leads 60 degrees, that one is called Trojans. And the one trailing are Greeks. So that the objects, the objects in the first clump are named after Trojan warriors and Trojan heroes from mythology. And the trailing one is the Greek camp. And NASA has actually...
And Jupiter is trying to keep the peace there, right? Between Troy and Greece.
Well,
right?
You know what?
The Roman god.
Like, much later. A later god is keeping the peace. Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and NASA has actually a mission called Lucy that is going to explore objects from both of these camps. From Jupiter Trojans, it will first go through. You know, it has such a kind of orbit that it's first going to swing through one cloud of Trojans,
wow.
And then it's going to go and explore. You know, the other one, and there's some really, you know, these objects are ancient. They're really telling us something about, you know, how the solar system was built.
What fraction of Jupiter's mass is represented in these trapped asteroids?
Oh, tiny. That's super tiny. When you think about it, actually, what is fascinating, you know, when you look at the main asteroid belt in general, I mean, so that's the main asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter. And there are millions of objects there, actually billions if you really count the small sizes. But if you were to sum up everything in the main belt.
If you were to glue them together into one object.
Together, it is less than 1/25 of our moon.
Okay.
And most of that mass is actually in asteroid, in dwarf planet Ceres.
Okay.
Ceres is about 1,000 kilometers across. So you can imagine, you know, if all that big mass of main asteroid belt is so tiny, and Trojans, I mean, if you were to sum up all Trojans, it's even less. It's really tiny.
So the idea of clearing your orbit, it just means there's nothing else big to compete with you. It doesn't mean there isn't debris and other junk that could be there as one of the criteria for planethood.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I definitely have to go and read up on my, you know, what is the exact definition.
But I can tell you this. Is it Jen? Jen asked this question?
Jen from Michigan.
Don't get me started here. So here's the point. There are other objects around where Pluto is orbiting the Sun that have mass that rival Pluto. So Pluto has not
it's so small,
cleared its orbit in that sense. Right, but you can have junk junk that doesn't...
So it's about who's the alpha in the situation.
Okay, Pluto's the alpha. Pluto's not the alpha dog, but Jupiter is totally the alpha planet.
Jupiter is.
Yeah, Jupiter completely dominates the solar system. Absolutely dominates.
Yeah. Yeah, it dominates not only its orbit, it's really... I agree. You know, Earth is the size of its storm, you know, its red spot.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's a...
So now the asteroid belt. So one of the asteroids in there, I have one named after me.
Yes, you
do. I got an asteroid. There's 13123 Tyson.
Yeah, you have it very easy. I mean, you're really kind of almost rhymes. 13123 Tyson.
Yes, easy. I don't have to. That's not a hard thing to remember.
Yes.
And just for people to know, that asteroid is not my password on anything. Okay. I just want you to know. Yeah. I'm not
that stupid. I think you're protesting a little too much.
So, yeah, I mean, your asteroid has quite an interesting story. Well, first of all, it was discovered by legends in field of asteroid. It was discovered in 1994 by Caroline Shoemaker and David Levy. And
yes, they got an asteroid hunting team like no other.
Yes, English majors, both of them.
Throwing it down. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is the power of amateur astronomy. Yes. Actually, they both went on to get all possible honorary degrees and awards in the field. I mean, they truly were legends in the field. And so, in 1994, they discovered asteroids called 1994 KA, which will later have your name. And yours is a binary asteroid. You know,
how come I didn't know that?
You are.
When did we find? Did you find that? How did I not know that?
In 2015, there was, I went looking, as I said, I went to their database.
Homework. Okay.
I know. And in 2015, there was a companion. So you have a primary that is about 11 kilometers in size. So nice size asteroid.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a satellite about 4 kilometers in size.
Wow.
And I can tell you that at least 15% of main belt asteroids are binaries. And similar amounts are binaries we have in near-Earth population. So okay, they have companions.
Last I checked, it was not a near-Earth.
No. You're main belt. I can also tell you.
Okay, and you can verify. Just verify for me.
Neil needed to verify that because imagine the bad press if the Neil deGrasse Tyson asteroid hits the
Earth. I know. It's the Earth. That would blow up on Twitter, I'm sure.
You would never live that down. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, well, I looked at your orbit and I really feel like I'm giving you a horoscope here.
I don't.
But,
doesn't that sound great? I looked at your orbit today.
I looked at your orbit. That sounds invasive
in some way.
That you are a little bit eccentric and slightly inclined.
Oh,
so
interesting.
So yes.
I like that. I don't mind being inclined and eccentric.
Yes, you know, everybody's in plane and you were kind of...
okay.
Yeah, you were kind of...
So inclined means the orbit is tipped
relative to the plane of the Earth orbit around the sun.
Of the solar system.
Looking up.
And then you have the... you said I'm a little bit eccentric.
Eccentric.
So not quite a perfect circular orbit.
You're not perfectly circular orbits, but yes, it is... It is actually a very, very cool object.
Well, thank you.
Orbiting a little bit outside orbit of Mars. So I'm glad it's not an asteroid belt.
It's not hitting Earth. That's all I care about.
No, not yet. I don't know. Maybe a couple of million years.
Don't say that. No.
It takes time. You know, only if all of the movies you have, you know, the something is a main belt, then 3 weeks later it is on Earth. You know, it's...
Correct.
Exactly.
Movies. They got to do it within 2 hours. They got to do it.
Yeah, that process takes usually a very long time. You know, we're talking millions of years until the, you know, objects from the main belt space end up migrating into the near Earth space.
Better hope it crashes into the ocean.
Well, then you have tsunamis on the.
Well,
oh,
look,
no, then that's your fault too.
11 kilometers. Yeah, that would be.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
That would be dinosaurs. I mean, that would be dinosaur size. I mean, that would be chicken loop size. So
right, exactly.
You do not want that size anywhere near.
No matter what.
That's a risk to have an asteroid named after you. That's the risk.
It's just the burden I carry, Martha. this is what I do. So give me another one. See if we can slip another question in before we break again.
Okay. This is from Connor Holm from Squim, Washington, from the Pacific Northwest. Hello. It says, hi. On average, what percentage of asteroids have moons? Is there an upper limit to how many moons an asteroid can have? I didn't even realize asteroids can have moons.
Let me top that up and say,
because we learned that you said about 15% are binary. So maybe if one is big and one is small, we'll say it's a moon. Can a moon have a moon? Can a moon have a moon?
That is a very good question. And if you look in orbital mechanics, there is no reason not to, but it's not going to be stable for a long time. So it's probably not going to be very long-lived. But we do have a triple systems, you know, in both main belt and in nearest population. They are rare. So you have a, you know, again, central object, which is the largest, and then you have two moonlets orbiting it. And we found so far only four in nearest population. So it's small. It's maybe 1%. As I said, those are all lower bounds because, you know, we can...
Wait, you're describing double moons rather than a moon with a moon.
Yes, correct. Triple system. So we have triple systems, but no, we have never found, you know, that moon has a moon. That would be very, very...
Well, maybe it's just a matter of definition because... Isn't Earth a moon of the sun?
Oh, it is all relative.
And then Earth has a moon.
Yes,
so
it's all relative. Yes,
we have a moon going around.
So everything's a moon.
Everything's a moon. Thank you.
Is the definition of a moon just anything that orbits something else?
Yeah, we usually say natural satellite. We would say that Earth is a natural satellite of the sun. And our moon is natural satellite of Earth. So it's kind of, you know.
I think there were some efforts to tighten that definition. Marina, correct me if I'm wrong. Pluto has a moon, except the center of mass of Pluto and its moon
is outside.
Outside.
Correct.
Right? So it's easier to think of Pluto as a double X-planet, mm-hmm. a double dwarf planet.
Yeah.
Than, you almost got me to say double planet there, but I'm not. As a double dwarf planet.
I'm taking
planet,
notes that, and recording it to the island.
Then as a main planet and a moon going around it. Whereas for Earth, our center of mass is within Earth's surface, between the Earth moon. So we can think of we being a primary and then the moon going around us. So is there any talk about where the center of mass is and if that affects the definition?
Well, in the case of asteroids, I'm telling you, all of these binaries you're dealing with a really large primary. The center of mass is always, you know, inside the primary. And I told you that we did find four equal mass binaries, but kind of we call them then equal mass binary because they're, you know, orbiting the common center of mass.
Right, right.
But they're rare. Those are very rare objects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, cool. All right, Marcia, slip one more in before the break.
Okay, one more before the break. This is from Kevin Browning. He says, "Hi, from White Deer, Texas. I just recently watched Deep Impact, and I was wondering if the idea of launching nuclear weapons to stop massive asteroids or comets is just Hollywood fantasy, or has it been something seriously discussed by scientists? Is it feasible, or is it something that is dated and no longer taken seriously?"
Wait, first.
Basically, is someone going to nuke Neil's asteroid if it starts coming towards Earth?
No one's going to nuke my asteroid, I'll tell you that. No. So two quick things before we go to break, because I think we'll have to answer that on the other side. Kudos to, what's his name again?
This is Kevin Browning from White Deer, Texas.
So kudos to Kevin for choosing the Deep Impact film to reference here, and not Armageddon, where Bruce Willis saves the world. I did some analysis of Armageddon, and it violates more known laws of physics per minute than any other movie ever made in the history of the universe. So, whereas Deep Impact actually had official advisors for it. So, kudos to him there. Now, you pronounced the word nuclear. Is that what he wrote?
I did? Wait. I think that probably is just how I said it. Nuclear.
What did he write?
He wrote nuclear.
The reason why I ask is because George Bush, former governor
nuclear.
Of Texas, pronounced nuclear. And I was he just an homage to his former governor?
Yeah.
That's what I was just checking.
No, he didn't spell it nuclear. I just said it like that because I'm from Oklahoma. So I thought
something
like that.
So
yeah.
Busted.
My accent came out.
Okay, we'll find out about Deep Impact, Fact or Fiction, when we return.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We're back. Star Talk. Cosmic Queries. All about asteroids. Love it. I got Marcia Belsky here, my co-host. Marcia, what's your social media footprint? Where can we find you?
My social media, everything is my name, at Marcia Belsky, MarciaBelsky, uh-huh. Except for on Instagram, I am at Marcia Sky, because I've had that handle forever. But yeah, find me there. I would love that. You know, like Neil said, I do musical comedy, and I also recently wrote a short comedy play called Man and Woman, so I post all of that information.
Oh, cool. Can find you there. Okay. And you're from Oklahoma and say nuclear. Okay, just want to...
And I'm from Oklahoma and apparently say nuclear, <That's right. laughs> which I didn't even realize I said
I'm
wrong.
I'm just calling you out. Just calling you out. And Marina Borsovic from Jet Propulsion Labs, are you on social media?
Actually, no. I am one of those, you know...
Okay, that means you actually get work done during the day.
Yes. I have email and phone, and
somehow... It's so healthy. If I didn't do comedy, I like to think that I wouldn't be on social media, because I can just feel it rotting my brain.
Okay, I know it's important.
But also follow me.
But Jet Propulsion Lab has an excellent public website for people to visit.
I know. They have a great educational site and a lot of good information.
And is it jpl.nasa.gov?
That is correct.
Okay. So a lot of good people making those websites. Excellent. So we left off by who's the guy again?
We left off with Kevin from White Deer, Texas. Kevin Browning.
He wanted to know.
He asked a question about nuclear.
So a couple of things. Let me tune that question for you, Marina. So other than deflection of an asteroid, which we know was tested with the DART mission, how realistic would nukes be burying them into was a comet that they dug into? And can you comment, if you've seen the film, can you comment on other sort of accurate or badly inaccurate physics that was in it?
Well, I did see Deep Impact, and I did see Armageddon. It was a while back, so I think I forgot a lot of my complaints.
it's to maintain your sanity over all the years.
I only remember good stuff. Okay,
it's a mental health factor.
But to make a kind of long story short, nuclear devices are a kind of last resort. If something is really big and we don't have much time to react, but in reality, we would have probably decades to prepare, and we would probably go with a kinetic impactor, you know, something that DART mission just demonstrated on Didymos system.
So kinetic impactor, it's moving so fast that the energy of the, its kinetic energy is sufficient to create the explosion that you're interested in.
Yeah, so there are two things there. You have to just push it. You don't want, there is a difference between deflection and disruption. Deflection is you just want to push it. Disruption is if you hit it too hard and it goes in pieces. And then you have much bigger mess because all of those pieces are heading your way.
Big mess.
It's a big mess. So if you decide to go with that kind of, you know, disruption, then you better give enough energy that all of them, you know, clear Earth. That you would probably have to do with the multiple kinetic impactors. That is,
or
that
we
is
need
not
a Death
easy.
Star. A Death Star could totally.
Oh yeah, if only Death
one
Star.
One or the other.
That would be. Oh well, you know, There was
just obliterated. It would Death Stars obliterate planets. That's what they do.
Wait, but that's comforting. You said that likely if there was any like major event that was going to disrupt Earth with the technology we have now, we'd have decades to prepare.
Yeah, as I said, the first and foremost, you have to find them. You know, you have to find them before they find us. That is kind of this cliche that we've been repeating, but it's so true. And that's why we have...
Find the sleeping bear before the bear finds you sleeping.
Yeah, oh my God. So that's, no pressure.
We have these, you know, NASA is funding a lot of these optical telescopes that are on every clear night going and looking up these, after these, after near-Earth asteroids that can potentially endanger Earth. And, you know...
Okay, but there's something you implied, but I want to sort of tease out here. And it's that, Marcia, I think Marina said that if we find one, we'll have perhaps 10 years, because the good thing is that anything big enough to render us extinct is easier to find.
Right.
Right? So...
That makes
well,
sense.
Okay, here's the good news. Here's the good news. We are really concerned with things that are larger than 1 kilometer, because those are the ones that really have global consequences, impact of that. And we have found more than 90% of those objects. So we think there may be maybe several dozens that we still have to find. But there, you know, some of them are not easy because they could have exotic orbits, like they can be very inclined. And, you know, and there can be kind of, you know, a lot of times in the bad geometry, so the Earth is on one side and they're behind the sun and you just kind of play this hide and seek for a long time. So you know, that's...
So, Marcia, those asteroids are sentient, so they know to hide in the glare of the sun.
Yeah, they're hiding like the ones from Jupiter, and we're like, get out of there.
Yeah.
We want to see you.
What?
So what would be like worst case scenario, like shortest amount of time we would have to like prepare?
But, okay.
If something huge was hurtling at
us. It's called kiss your ass goodbye. That's the solution there, yeah.
Yeah, it's as I said, it's extremely unlikely that that would happen, because as I said, we found more than 90% of that population. We are very concerned about so global consequences. But we still have a lot of work between this smaller population. So we think anything, you know, between 140 meters to 1 kilometer, that is pretty serious as well. We found about 50% of that population. So we still have a way to go.
So as the size gets smaller, we have less and less of the total known in our catalogs. Just because they're harder to track.
Very, very much so. Okay. And we are also very concerned with this population that is between, say, 50 meters and 140 meters. It doesn't look much, but, you know, that is at the level of a city, extremely dangerous. And we really know very small population there.
So the kilometer-sized asteroids are enough to disrupt civilization in some fundamental way.
Yeah.
Right? Correct. Supply chains, transportation.
Yeah, they basically, they would kick agriculture. so much dust. They would kick so much dust up in the atmosphere that, you know, you would end up that plants would start having problems with photosynthesis, and then the whole chain reaction with the, you know, with the food, with food chains would collapse. Yeah.
But Marcia, you know who would really have the problem? Anyone was who? Where it was, where it hit.
That's what I'm thinking too. I'm like, and if it hit Manhattan,
that's where the real problem is.
Actually, we have enough telescopes pointed here.
Going back to Neil's asteroid that was discovered in 1994, you know what else happened in 1994? And really,
oh
kind
yes,
of started,
oh my
right?
gosh!
Want to tell us
that? That wasn't the Shoemaker Levy nine.
Correct.
Slamming. So this was the first time we ever witnessed a major comet slamming into another object in the solar system. And it was a comet that broke apart from gravity, okay? Yes. And it was slammed into Jupiter, and one piece after another hit. And the Hubble telescope was just freshened a couple of years earlier, and we turned every ground-based telescope to it. In fact, I was at an observatory in Chile, and I took time out of my observing plan to get data on that comet. And you know what was cool? And see, I'm getting all excited. Thanks, Marcia and Marina, for sending me on to this. So because it was a comet that broke apart, each piece became its own comet. So each piece had its own tail. It was the coolest thing. And yeah, it slammed into Jupiter, killing all the dinosaurs on Jupiter.
I was like, poor Jupiter. It doesn't deserve that.
And yeah, Jupiter's discovered. It was discovered by the same people that discovered your asteroid.
They are legends.
There it is.
Well, you were missing Carolyn Shoemaker and David Levy also discovered your asteroid. And then there was also Gene Shoemaker.
He was
the third. They discovered it from Palomar here, just in the neighborhood. It was like 40 centimeter telescope. They discovered it in 93. And then in 94, it slammed them to Jupiter. It was incredible. I mean,
right.
Gosh.
Yeah, one of the great moments. And so what I wonder is, who was looking at our planet when that same size asteroid hit Earth and took out the dinosaurs? Was someone else getting excited when they saw that? See, that's what I'm wondering.
There was some alien civilization. It's like, poor.
Dinosaurs did not have a space program, but we do.
Yeah, you know, if they had a space program, they'd still be here, because they would have totally deflected that asteroid.
I mean, this sounds like an amazing Pixar movie. Like, should we pitch this?
The dinosaurs dinosaurs with NASA, right? That's what that is.
Yeah, and they prevent their own.
Well, they said it's sort of been done. Now this is down the rabbit hole here, but Ice Age 5, the animated series, I actually have a cameo in that. Otherwise would not know, and I wouldn't even know it had five installations. So apparently they discover, these are like Ice Age mammals, they discover that there's an asteroid headed their way and they want to deflect it. And so I show up inside one of the creature's heads, Buck Weasel, and I'm Neil DeBuck Weasel, and I'm just in his head, telling him what to think about. And so they deflect the asteroid. Animals have deflected the asteroid. Sentient, conversational, smart mammals other than humans have done this in the past, as evidenced by this documentary, Ice Age 5.
The well-known documentary. Yeah.
Let's keep going. See if we can get a couple more in here.
Absolutely. Okay, so this is from Dylan. I feel like this kind of leads from what we were just talking about. It's about a different movie. It says, greetings, everyone. I was wondering how you guys felt about the movie Don't Look Up. Is that really how we would react? And what could you/we do to have a better outcome? I feel like you were kind of getting into this, that the myth of that movie is how fast it would happen, maybe.
Yeah.
Well,
a quick earlier point to Marina's notion that we might have 10 years. In Armageddon, it was a Texas-sized asteroid.
I know.
That was within months of hitting Earth. And a Texas-sized asteroid would have been discovered 200 years ago. So, the government could not keep, there's no way the government can keep it a secret. It's in the freaking sky. See, you got me started on Armageddon. I told you it violated more laws of physics per minute than any other. Let's leave that.
There are a lot of space conspiracies, and I think they are hinged upon the idea that somehow these things could be kept
a secret. The government prevents the whole world from knowing what's in the sky. I assume you saw it. Don't Look Up, Marina.
I did not, but I do roughly know. I do roughly know the premise. Going back to what Marcia already started saying, you know, it's everybody thinks that there is this one telescope on Earth that can observe asteroids. And there is one person that knows how to do asteroid orbit. All that is, you know, public information.
Right.
And actually, we have this kind of clearinghouse for data, where everybody in this world that observes asteroids sends in their measurements.
Immediately. So by the way,
it's not some guy in a cave who then has to call.
Information is public. Everybody has access to this data. We as a scientist, we love to talk. So it's impossible that we would keep anything a secret.
Plus, the government is not competent enough to accomplish any such cover-ups that are displayed in the movies.
There's no way.
So one of my most retweeted tweets in the past 2 years was when I said, I watched the Don't Look Up, this fictional tale of an asteroid where a scientist warns and people reject the warnings and social media takes it lightly. And then I said, by the time the movie was done, I'm certain it was not fiction. It was a documentary, indeed. That was how I thought about it. So yeah, it scares the hell out of me. Even though it was a little bit comical, Marina, it was... I've been enough in social media and interacting with the press and with people that so much of what I've seen and felt was pumped up and exaggerated for the movie, but it's all there. Mm-hmm. They didn't pull that out of nowhere. There was a plausibility to it that left me a little scared.
In terms of how we would react to any sort of global catastrophe.
Marcia, I don't want to be the laughingstock of the galaxy by being the only species with enough intellect to have a space program, but with enough stupidity to not know what to do with it.
Oh, you know we're already there. You know that if they've been watching us with their telescopes, they're like, these idiots.
Stop. Don't say that. I don't want to hear that.
Right. Well, you know, we have every 2 years, we have this planetary defense conference where you have experts from, you know, from scientists to engineers to, you know, space mission planners to even kind of politicians, government officials, even United Nations. Everybody gathers in one spot. And then we have this, what do you do? You know, there are people that are negotiating. You know, there are politicians that are going like, okay, who is sending what? You know, who is sending reconnaissance mission? Every spacefaring nation will contribute this. And so there you have...
If an asteroid is headed for the Indian Ocean and we have technology that could help it, who pays for that mission? Right.
Right. That would be a better one. If you want to deflect it, then say it is going to impact country A. But if you want to deflect and save everybody, it is going to, the corridor, impact corridor will have to pass over countries C, D, and E in order to move it off the Earth.
And if you don't fully execute that.
And that's what they'd really do.
You have other targets. Yeah, the asteroid has new targets.
That's probably what would end up happening. They'd be like, oh, let's just send it to this country.
Those are interesting questions. Those are interesting questions, but that's why.
Geopolitical
questions. Many people are working on this because, you know, we need to have protocols in place.
I'm delighted that you're on the front lines there, Marina. Yeah, we got good people doing good stuff. Trying to save the species.
I don't get as worried. Yeah.
Well,
I feel like the difference between that and the global warming, though, is like there's no financial incentives for companies to allow an asteroid to hit us. You know what I mean? I feel like we'd get our butts together.
That is so encouraging to hear that. I don't know myself, but think of all the things we do that reduce our life expectancy every day.
I know.
Every day.
But if I may add, I think that in recent polls, actually, I think that public is very much aware of the need for us to find all the potentially hazardous asteroids. So I think that the public is that we have kind of public in our corner with respect to this.
Yeah, go look at
issue.
Go look at the movie Don't Look Up, and you
will. I will.
Reverse that comment.
It is too believable the way that the public reacts in that movie. Yeah,
guys, we gotta land this ship. This has been great, informative, and thank you, Marcia, for sharing your joy and comedic outlooks with us. And Marina, it was a delight to have you on our Rolodex.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being on Star Talk. This has been a Star Talk Cosmic Queries Edition. Asteroids. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, as always, bidding you to keep looking up.